We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. And a big, big thank you to everybody that that gave last week.
Yes. That was awesome.
We went well beyond our goal, and that should keep us set for another 5-6 months. So
yeah.
Really appreciate people who contributed then, who have contributed in the past. And
yes, thank you all.
And if you'd still like to contribute, I'm sure the station wouldn't turn it down.
They would be happy to.
Yeah, you can just go to the website and click on the donate button.
Yep. All right. Hey, let's do as we usually do and dissect some of this past week's happenings, starting with the mayor's race and some endorsements.
Dissect?
Yes, we will dissect the the mayor's race. Well, I want to talk this week about Ed Murray's endorsements. This week he gained the endorsement of the Seattle Police Union. They think Murray can take control versus McGinn, who has seemed scattered and I guess out of control.
And it's been interesting because many of his sort of apologetics for the worst of the SPD's abuses over the last several years have been specifically with the intent of getting the support and the favor
of the police union.
Anti-crime voters and the police union, yeah.
Yeah, and it's helpful.
Didn't work.
It's helpful to remember that the police union's a hierarchy, a lot like the military. And you know, when you're in a hierarchy and that's what you owe your allegiance to and your job to, you tend to want a strong, fearless leader. So the head of the police union had a lot to say in support of Murray, but he's not too impressed with McGinn. Now, Murray's also received some other endorsements from municipal unions. Like, he got the endorsement of the firefighters union fairly recently, and also he's gotten the endorsement of the transit workers union. So that's not a good sign for McGinn when you have the municipal unions kind of turning against him.
Yeah, it tells you that he's been their boss for the last 4 years, and they weren't impressed.
Yeah. Murray also this week got his fifth endorsement from a city council member. Jean Godden came out for him, so that now puts her in the same camp as Tom Rasmussen, Sally Clark, former mayoral candidates Tim Burgess and Bruce Harrell, and now the whole a five-person majority of the city council is saying we're not happy with the current mayor either.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that four of them have endorsed McGinn, because several have also decided to stay on the sidelines and
stay
not make
neutral.
Endorsement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually pretty typical of the city council. Most city council members tend to stay neutral in a mayor's race, but you may have like one or two come out in favor of a candidate. But this is the first time in a long time that a majority has said we're not with the incumbent.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Initiative 522.
Yeah. Initiative 522, the GMO labeling initiative. Its supporters, the folks who rolled out the initiative and are backing it, took the anti-I-522 campaign to court this week in Thurston County Superior Court. They told the judge that they think the No on 522 campaign is breaking Washington state public disclosure laws. One of its top five donors is the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has given the No on 522 campaign about $2.2 million out of their total $11 million in campaigns that they've received to date.
Yes, and mind you, that doesn't make them their top donor, just one of several top
donors. One of its five top five donors. And, you know, they have to list their top five donors in all of their commercials on TV. That's a requirement of the disclosure laws here in the state of Washington. And they do they've rolled out their TV commercials this week, and they do list the Grocery Manufacturers Association.
And you'll be seeing a lot more of those commercials.
But this week, the I-522 supporters, the Yes on 522 campaign, said that the Grocery Manufacturers Association is really functioning as a PAC or a public action committee. PACs usually just are formed to raise money to support or defeat a particular candidate or a particular cause. The Grocery Manufacturers Association is a membership organization. It's a lobbying group on behalf of the food industry, and it doesn't consider itself a PAC, and most people wouldn't, except the Yes on 522 campaign folks are saying, well, hey, the Grocery Manufacturers Association has sent out specific appeals to its members to raise money to support the No on 522 campaign. So that makes them, since they're functioning as a PAC, that means they have to disclose who their donors are under Washington state disclosure laws, and they haven't been doing that. So we will see whether the judge agrees with them or not.
Any idea on when that ruling will come down?
No, I don't have any idea.
Probably December.
I'm guessing. I'm hoping, like a lot of folks, it'll be before November.
All right. Plastic bags, something that was an initiative.
Yeah, down in Thurston County this week, some bad news and good news. The bad news is that the contractor that handles Thurston County's recycling contract is no longer going to accept plastic film, which is to say plastic bags, beginning next month. According to the head of their firm, there's just no market for them. It's a demonstration once again that when you entrust a public good to a private company that is motivated solely by how profitable it is, those aren't always congruent goals. The good news that's coming out of that, though, is the city of Tumwater this week passed a ban on plastic bags in advance of that, that they're no longer being recyclable. And both the city of Olympia and Thurston County itself are expected to do so shortly. That would make Thurston County the first county to countywide ban plastic bags. We've had a number of cities, including last year the city of Seattle, that have passed that ordinance, cities and municipalities, but there hasn't been a full county that's done it so far. And obviously in places like Seattle and Bellingham and some of the smaller cities that have passed these, the sky hasn't fallen. People have adjusted just fine, and life goes on. So it makes one wonder, when can we expect this to happen statewide? Because it sure does make a difference environmentally, and it's a very minimal inconvenience to anybody except the American Chemical Association.
Another fine lobbying group. All right, let's move on to national. And the Republicans were busy this week.
Yes, the Republicans in the House were very busy this week. But you might ask, might fairly ask, what were they really getting done? The answer is not very much, and not anything that was particularly good. They were picking on poor people again. Kicking them off food stamps. This week, the Republicans in the House passed a bill to fund the food stamp program, which they had spent quite a bit of time last session trying to gut. And when they couldn't do that, they separated it off from the farm bill so that they could vote on the food stamp separately.
Normally, it's a part of the farm bill, which is an automatic bipartisan thing. And the trade-off is always, well, you know,
Get the food stamps, and the Republicans get the farm subsidies.
Yeah, and that's actually more of an urban-rural divide, but in some ways that's how it plays out also. But the conflict this past summer was the Republicans wouldn't pass a farm bill because it helped poor people.
Yeah, which is not typically true. There's a lot more fraud in the farm bill program than there is in the food stamp program. One of the arguments that the Republicans made was, well, we don't want to pass the two together because there's so much fraud in the food stamp program, which is the reverse of reality. Instead, they passed a farm bill that still contained a lot of the same opportunities for fraud than it did before. And they split off the food stamp bill. And then this week they passed a bill for the food stamp program that would make enormous cuts in the program that would push about 4 million people off of food stamps this year alone, and about 3 million a year for the next 10 years. Now, I just want to point out, 15% of Americans live in poverty, according to the Census Bureau.
And higher percentage of children.
Yeah, and that's about 45 million people total. And that really corresponds very closely with the number of people who are receiving food stamps. So essentially what the Republicans did this week is they said, well, we're going to take a bunch of poor people, people living in poverty, those that don't have children between the ages of 18 and 50, we're going to let them have 3 months of food stamps, and then we're going to kick them to the curb. Essentially, that's what they did. And you have to be, you know, if you look at this stuff and you really have to ask yourself, these Tea Party Republicans who really pushed for this, their electorate contains a lot of rural America, and rural America is where a lot of the poverty is right now since the recession began in 2007 and 2008. You know, large portions of the Midwest and the South have just really fallen through the cracks in terms of the economy. And you have to ask yourself, is there going to be any political consequences for these Tea Party Republicans by doing these kinds of things? Because they're really telling their electorate in particular, we don't care about you.
Yes. And by the way, fraud is fine when big agribusiness commits it.
Yeah.
It's just when poor people who aren't actually committing it, you know, we can point at them. And since God has told us that they're just naturally dishonest or they wouldn't be poor, something. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we'll get back to the pathology of the modern Republican several more times in the next few minutes.
Yeah. And then another thing that the Republicans in the House did this week is they voted for the 40th time to defund the Affordable Care Act. So not only are they saying, you know, we don't want poor people to eat, we also don't want them to have health care. This time they
the two go hand in hand, by the way.
Yeah. This time they voted to defund the Affordable Care Act as part of the stopgap budget that was going to extend the federal government so that it wouldn't close down on September 30th. It would extend operations until December 15th. Because, of course, in the last session, the Republicans in the House made it, you know, the extreme right Republicans in the House made it impossible to pass a budget bill that would fund the government for the entire fiscal year. Now they have to do a stopgap budget. And so when they voted on the stopgap budget, they said, well, gosh, okay, this is our opportunity. Let's, for the 40th time, try to defund the Affordable Care Act. Because, you know, you can't let poor people get a little bit of a subsidy in order to get health care coverage. That's just beyond the pale.
And it's really interesting because you're getting this split in the Republican caucus between Republican leadership like John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, who are saying, look, just procedurally, there is no way at this point to stop an implementation of the Affordable Care Act. It cannot be done with only a majority in the House of Representatives, but not holding the Senate, not holding the White House.
Right.
You know, they will send this legislation on to the Senate. The Senate will vote it down, which they can do with 50% plus one under the procedures for this type of bill. And then it'll be back in the House's hands again.
Yeah. It's just a time waster.
It's a complete time waster. It prevents Congress. It's a manufactured crisis. It prevents Congress from, considering other legislation of any kind, which is probably something that the Tea Party considers a plus. And then, you have also coming up the need in about 2 weeks after the end of the month deadline. There's another deadline coming up for the debt ceiling, and there's going to be a whole fiasco around that as well. And it's just from one manufactured crisis to another manufactured crisis. Because you have these ideologues who are not just incapable of compromise, but also incapable of recognizing that they are not running the government.
Right. And, you know, the main
the majority of Americans didn't vote for them.
Yeah. And, you know, the main reason they want to hold the government hostage over the debt ceiling is so that they can they're at the top of their list is to get the Keystone XL pipeline approved. So here you've got these folks who say we're for poor rural Americans, whatever. You know, we're for the average guy. We want to get the government off your back. Well, yeah, they do want to get the government off your back, but they want to be able to climb on in its place. Them and their companies that they're shareholders of, you know, they're willing to go all out to support, you know, oil companies, but they're not willing to do a thing, lift a finger to support Americans who can't get a job as part of this lame recovery that we have. And also, I want to talk too this week about yet another census report that was released on Tuesday about median income in the United States. It turns out that median income is the same now in 2012 as it was in the late 1980s when you adjust for inflation. In other words, it's been a lost generation. There have been no gains since the late 1980s.
Gee, what does that coincide with politically, I'm thinking, in terms
right.
of public policy?
Right. And you know, poverty levels have increased because the income gap is not the same as it was in the 1980s. The rich and the poor were a lot closer together in terms of income than they are now. And this report actually is a conservative report because it doesn't include earnings for capital gains, that's sales of stock and other property, which tend to accrue to very rich Americans. As we know, 90% of all stock is owned by the rich. So this report is kind of conservative in showing you what the wealth gap truly is.
Yeah. And for that matter, while we're on the historic and continuing depredations of the Republican Party, I should mention that a Texas appellate judge threw out Tom DeLay's, the former Speaker of the House, his 2010 jury conviction for money laundering dating back to the 2002 election when he laundered a bunch of corporate money to put into Texas races that gave Texas Republicans through gerrymandered districts from the 2000 census, even before they did it in mid-decade and then again in 2010, control of the congressional delegation from Texas. It was thrown out due to, quote, insufficient evidence, even though the jury had thought otherwise. And it's kind of quaint for a couple of reasons. I mean, there was plenty of evidence in this case. It's a pretty questionable ruling by the judge. But what DeLay was convicted of in 2002 is now completely legal, thanks to the 2010 Citizens United ruling. The Supreme Court decreed that, yeah, corporate money in elections, you can spend as much of that as you like. That's, money is free speech and corporations are people, therefore.
And their free speech is freer and more abundant than ours.
Yeah. $1,
based on the amount of $1 they can
vote.
Spend.
The other interesting part of it, of course, is that, you know, that whole class of Republicans that took over Congress in the late 90s and early 2000s and during Bush time, came in claiming to, wanting to throw out the insiders who were running Washington, et cetera, et cetera. Turned out to be incredibly corrupt. All the stuff that was going around, Jack Abramoff, even though he spent 4 years in jail, none of his cronies did. You still have Ralph Reed around today and Grover Norquist and a number of the Congress people. The nature of the Republican Party, even in these past 7 or 8 years, has changed quite dramatically because the class of Republican that dominates the Republican congressional caucus now, it really isn't smart enough to be pulling off these kind of elaborate corruption schemes.
That we know of.
Yeah, that we know of. Either that or they just play stupid on TV. But I'm thinking in a number of cases they really are that divorced from reality and clueless. It really has underscored how the sort of wealthy insiders that used to run the Republican Party and do the bidding of corporations in part because they wanted to make money for themselves and their cronies. It's been replaced by this entire generation who's willing to do it absolutely free, because they're ideologically motivated and because they aren't really living in the same universe as the rest of us. I actually think I prefer to have the corrupt guys.
All right. Well, I saw last week after we finished our show that Larry Summers announced that he was pulling out.
Yeah, there's been this big push on the left, or at least the liberal left, to make sure that when Ben Bernanke's term as Fed chairman is up near the end, close to the end of this year, that Lawrence Summers not be the next Fed chairman. And there are several reasons for that. A lot of people see Lawrence Summers because he was for not regulating derivatives during the Clinton administration, that he was pretty directly responsible for, he and others, pretty directly responsible for the economic crisis in 2007 and 2008.
Yeah, he was one of the forces behind the repeal of Glass-Steagall, for example.
And he holds some pretty controversial beliefs about women and our ability to think, which would lead a lot of us women to say he's very sexist.
Actually, it leads some men to say that too.
And some men to say that too. And Summers has other problems in his past as well. But I don't see Janet Yellen as being a heck of a lot. She's another candidate. She's the current vice chairman of the Fed, as being a heck of a lot better. When it really comes down to who runs the Fed, all of the top contenders are pretty much the same. I mean, whoever gets into the office is going to continue Bernanke's zero interest rate policies, which benefit the big banks and which are really screwing the retirees and people who are trying to save, who are close to retirement. I just really don't see, and a lot of people I think, had a good argument when they said that Greenspan's low, ultra-low interest rate policies led to a big rise in housing prices and was also a main contributor to the housing bubble and the economic crisis that happened afterwards in the downturn. And I don't see any difference between Greenspan's low interest rate policies and the current zero interest rate policies, which, you know, if you ask investors right now, like Warren Buffett is a main example, they will tell you that the ultra low interest rate policies of the Fed have led to another rise in asset prices, which is code word for another inflation or another bubble, inflation of that asset bubble. And asset bubbles, when they tend to burst, they do a lot of damage.
Yeah. And I think in terms of the progressive left and their desire to get Summers out, I think in part this is a reaction to the legacy of Greenspan, because really he became a cult of personality in D.C. over the 20-plus years that he was chairman of
and
the
Summers
Fed.
And Summers could easily do that as well.
And that's the concern. But the difference is that when Greenspan came in, D.C. was a very different place. The banking and finance industry in the 1980s was not 40%+ of the economy the way it is today, and it did not have a stranglehold on policy orthodoxy within Congress the way that it does today.
And you also didn't have markets moving on a dime like they do now. You know, when the Fed announces, tries to, in the past, it could kind of prepare people, could prepare the economy for things like the changes it would make, like raising interest rates and stuff. It could announce, well, we're thinking of doing this, and then a couple months later announcing, well, we're thinking of doing this in our meeting, you know, a couple months from now, and the markets would slowly adjust to it. Well, nowadays they make an announcement like that, and immediately the same day the markets shoot up or drop into the basement. So the markets, because of the computerized activity now, and particularly with the extremely high volume traders who can make millions of trades in a few seconds every day, the markets move very, very quickly, and they move on a dime, and that's a very, very different situation.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole argument that Yellen should be supported because she would be the first woman to run the Fed. I mean, it was, you know, basically the same argument saying that, well, if we elected a black president, they'll rein in Wall Street, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was just talking about how the markets move so rapidly. It kind of leads you to ask who is kind of chair in the economy. Is it the Fed chair who's steering the economy, or is it these high frequency traders and the market? And I would argue that it's really the market. It's not the Fed chairman anymore. Really, the Fed has to respond to what the markets are doing.
Yep. And that's not a good thing.
No.
All right. On to Syria.
Yeah. The U.S. and Russia came to a preliminary agreement on a plan to disarm Syria of its chemical weapons through a U.N. inspection program. Now, the U.N. Security Council is hammering out the details on a draft resolution that's been submitted by the U.S., Britain, and France. And that draft resolution contains a couple of flaming hoops. Now, I call them flaming hoops because usually when the U.S. proposes a resolution in the Security Council, it's with an end in mind. And in order to get that end that they want, our government usually puts at least one flaming hoop in there for the opposition to have to jump through in order to get the resolution passed. And if they don't jump through that flaming hoop, then we reserve the right to pound them with military might. And that's exactly what that's exactly what's going on with this resolution in the UN Security Council right now. There's a couple big flaming hoops. The first one is that if the Syrian government doesn't comply to all provisions of the resolution, the Security Council must use force against it. There's no wording in the resolution to say that the Security Council could then consider its options, like imposing sanctions or doing some other kind of punishment.
Or even what the context is. For example, if, say, a random individual country prevented them from complying with you know, one or another provision because, you know, The interference was not the result of the Syrian government, but it was sort of, say, the United States taking
or
action.
Or the rebels or fighting or something beyond their control. So, no, that's the first flaming hoop. The second flaming hoop is that Syria must declare, give up and destroy over 1,000 tons, what the U.S. and Russia agree is about 1,000 tons of chemical weapons by mid-2014, a timeline that would require, I think, a superhuman feat in order to meet. So that's the second
point. And that in peacetime.
Yeah.
Which they're in the middle of a civil war.
And they're in the middle of a civil war. And I think the third kind of hidden flaming hoop that's not in the resolution is the actual situation on the ground in Syria. We got news this week that the rebel army has pretty much split in two in northern and eastern Syria, and the jihadis are fighting the Free Syrian Army for control of several cities in northern and eastern Syria, and as it turns out, the jihadis are pretty much winning in a lot of those places.
Yep. So now we've got a three-way civil war, basically.
All right. Greenpeace.
Yeah. News came out that Thursday evening. The Russian security services has seized a Greenpeace ship and crew, the crew of the ship Arctic Sunrise, in international waters in the Arctic Ocean, in Pechora Sea near the island of Novaya Zemlya. I hope I'm pronouncing
Novaya
that right.
Novaya Zemlya.
My Russian is rusty. But this was after a protest at a new offshore oil rig owned by the state oil company and scheduled to start pumping oil next spring. Two activists from Greenpeace had scaled the rig on Wednesday and were detained. But this is unprecedented for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of the actions of those activists, all of the crew members were arrested and the ship was seized. And this was done in international waters, both of which there's literally no precedent for. The crew itself is from countries all over the world. Only four of the crew members were actually Russians. The rest came from a variety of different countries, including one American, but also from a number of European countries and other various places around the world. They're all being taken to Murmansk, which is the closest major Russian city, and will probably get there on Monday because it is quite a distance that they have to go from pretty far north in the Arctic Ocean. So there's a lot of diplomatic activity going on around this right now, and we'll keep an eye on it.
Actually, wouldn't the Mavi Marmara be a precedent that was similar? Seizure of ship and
off the coast of Israel.
Mm-hmm. And everyone on board in international waters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that wasn't for...
It was a bad precedent.
It was a bad precedent, yeah. And it certainly wasn't anything that the international community considered legal, but...
But didn't particularly do anything about either.
Right. Well, yes, but that was Israel.
I know.
International law apparently doesn't apply.
All right, events.
Yeah, number of events. We're getting back into the fall busy season again. For the first and maybe biggest one is this morning. 350.org is sponsoring all across the country, including here in Seattle, anti-Keystone XL rallies. And because he was going to be in town anyway, I'll get to that in a second, Bill McKibben is going to be part of that rally. That starts at 11 o'clock, 11 to 2 today at Myrtle Edwards Park. So start heading on down there because that's going to be a crowded and big deal. Monday... McKibben will be speaking in the evening at Town Hall, 7:30 p.m. I guess he has a new book out, The Education of a Reluctant Activist. Probably already sold out for that, but if you can try and get tickets, good luck to you. Also on Monday from noon to 2 p.m., there will be a showing of Reclaiming Prosperity, Inequality for All, the documentary winner at Sundance this year, and something very relevant to the item Maria was talking about earlier about income inequality in this country. That's at the Harvard Exit. It's a free screening. It's on Harvard off of Broadway on Capitol Hill. Tuesday, Real Change is having its annual breakfast fundraiser. It's become a really big deal, actually, 7:30 to 9 a.m. at the Washington State Convention Center. Wednesday, September 25th, from 7 to 9 p.m., meet Sister Lucy in Seattle, Mayor's Hope of Model for Oppressed Women and Children. That's a presentation that will happen at Good Shepherd Center, 4749 North Sunnyside in Wallingford. And then on Thursday, the 26th, if you'd like to hear from the Foreign Policy Establishment, Kenneth Pollack will be in town at Town Hall talking about our problem with Iraq. Who's this we you speak of, white man? that'll be $5, and go and bring your pointed questions at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.